again, that you don't have a centralized system, a centralized ethical system, a centralized church that would be responsible for everything, but much more individual, and this consciously. Now, the thing that was discovered, and that really is maybe a little hopeful, that this way of thinking, which we are experiencing right now, is not the only one, is not the first one. That this is a movement that has been taking place for centuries. It started for the first time, people say, in Egypt, then especially in the after the Italian Renaissance in the 16th century. What usually is called the Romantic movement would also be such a movement. And then the greatest one is the one we are experiencing right now, our 20th century thinking, art, everything. So the hopeful thing about this is that one day it might go up again or go down. This depends on your point of view. In other words, that we are experiencing this ebb or tide right now, and that we should have the opposite pretty soon.
Is this an approach to understanding, or is it a philosophy in itself?
Right, this is an approach to understanding in that you view it historically. You see, that you say our period is not something isolated, but it is something that in a similar form has already taken place for the last time in the 19th century. Then in the Baroque period, the Romantic period, and the so-called original Mannerism period in the 15th century in Italy.
But you still use the analytical method of trying to understand.
All right, definitely. So this is something actually where we don't have an answer for, but there were some indications in the discussion last time that this that there already is a trend of centralizing again, that this intentional destruction of forms, of systems and thinking, of social structures is over, that the hippie age is already nearing its end, or the screaming noises in music that really are no music.
Isn't that something you said in a sense last night, Cavi, that there, when he said, I don't want to tie to the ages, and but that you noticed that there are changes within the society which the element of the society which has been rejecting it can more accept that there is a change as you see it?
I think the whole society is changing rather than just an element. But I think the element that appears to be the most changing are the ones who are the most readily accepting the changes in society, rather than really society is a static thing and some people are just breaking away from it. I think society is changing, and the people who are appear to be changing the most.
From this point of view, actually, this you are saying that we are moving toward a mannerist, in quotation marks, period.
Well, I don't know what that means, mannerist.
Let's say the destruction of systems, the destruction of art forms, intentional destruction, or putting things together which actually should not be put together.
He used yesterday, non-harmonizing.
Right. Intentionally non-harmonizing, non-concentrated.
I'm not sure.
So the rebellion against something structured or harmonized is only the first step.
And from there
you go on and say what we have now, the destruction, that's what we like, and that's how it should be.
I think the destruction has taken place, but out of that has to, something comes.
Right.
The same thing he's saying.
Yeah. Is there anything new about that? Society has always been changing, and these destruction of one art form, the creation of another, actually, one really doesn't destroy one. One only creates a new one or a new form, and that's a natural thing. History is full of evidence of that. It's an expression of the new people, the new generation, the people who see something. They get tired of the old art forms and create a new one.
Right.
This is not new at all. And only when you're too close to it do you feel that there's something revolutionary going on in society. You blow up the hippie philosophy, for example, is not new at all.
No, it's not, and yet,
if you get too close to it, you feel maybe that we're living in a time when everything is different. And only a study of history can show that this is just...
This is what they try to show in this, with this idea of mannerism, that this is actually a recurring thing.
But if we reject
it is not just something new.
Yes.
But it is new in that it is destroying everything that is there before. Yeah. For instance, nowadays all the guys are having this long hair.
Which is not new.
which isn't new, but what actually does it mean? It is almost forbidden among young people to wear short hair. This means to be masculine.
And as soon as the
so the difference between the sexes,
the hair
you know,
on, the kids will cut it off again.
It's right, but it is more than that. It's not only it is a revolt, but it does not lead us to understanding it. I would say,
yeah.
You see, because why can't a man say I am a man? Why can't a woman say I am a woman? Fine. But why mix this? Why should you blur this? Why should you destroy again, in other terms, this structure?
This is just a failure to appreciate the important values. I mean, these are peripheral things. And in time, you get over that kind of thing.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Have you ever looked at the famous Mona Lisa from this point of view? There's one American painter who painted a little beard on that. And he or she is a perfect man. And also this in between, you know, you don't really know, is she smiling or is she crying?
Yeah.
This vagueness actually that makes that painting interesting.
Yeah, but isn't that the essence of all art? You get out of it your own subject.
No, usually not. You try to give one definite answer according to the classical or Renaissance, whatever you want to call it.
Many painters don't agree with that in themselves. They paint what they feel, but it doesn't necessarily suggest.
Yeah, but they still come up with something.
Yeah.
You see, there is a result, there is a finished product, so to speak. It is not that you can say the painting means A, B, C, D, no. But it is finished in a certain way. But they intentionally destroy this in the Mannerist movement. They say, we do not want to come up with something that's finished.
Well, let me just ask one question and I'll shut up. I don't understand how the old forms get really destroyed. I don't know how far back you go, but the Michelangelo kind of art, the sculpture, the old masters, true painting has changed, sculpture has changed, but do you really destroy the old in developing new forms?
I would say only we don't appreciate them anymore. Let's say in the 19th century, early 20th century, everybody thought, you mentioned Michelangelo, that the David or the famous Pietà, you know, which was shown in the exhibition, that this was about his greatest work. You know, nowadays, most critics, I would say, would say that this is an early stage in his development, and this is by far not the greatest. This is something so perfect that it leaves us cold. It is so well done. We look at it and say, well, marvelous. So what? Let's have a glass of wine in the next tavern, you know, or something like this. But people much more tend to look at the figures of that tomb which he never finished.
Mm-hmm.
This tomb of the Pope, which was a Giulio so-and-so, maybe, I don't know, the second
Pope.
Right, this rather cruel Pope who commissioned this thing. And this is not finished, and many people say intentionally not finished. Mm-hmm. He just left the slaves, you know, in the marble, and as soon as you could discover one arm, one muscle, that already shows the labor this guy has to do. You don't have to polish the marble, you know. This is enough. You get much more of the word that poor guy has to do in this simple structure. And people look at this, amazingly enough. They like this. This appeals to them. This does not mean the other one is destroyed. But to our thinking, which follows this kind of art, actually, or which runs parallel, the figures, the slaves from the tomb, are much more appealing than the David or the Pietà.
Because I look at it as going off in new directions, not because the old is no good, but simply because that has been followed to a great degree and people may react against it. For example, the reason nobody tried to out-Wagner is because the new composers, the new people who are interested in opera, they felt they just couldn't improve on that. So it took off in the
different,
isn't that correct?
Different, yeah. And there were hundreds of imitations, of course. I mean, first there was a Michelangelo, first there was a Wagner, and then many people who did not have the talent imitated this, and then it became a hollow, empty form, you know, and then the revolt took place against it. It's a good revolt.
Did you see the influence of Wagner and Strauss and so much?
Oh, definitely so. Yeah.
Looking back on the Mannerist periods in the history of art, would you say that in length of time, do they tend to be shorter than the classical?
Yes. Just from the simple fact they don't create that much. Their basic attitude is not to create, not to paint a beautiful portrait, but just to leave something vague in between. You know, this Mona Lisa thing is an excellent
and
example.
Apparently, the human mind really doesn't like that.
No.
enough. We seem to want a sense of harmony and order.
No, just to do something, to create something, to be happy with the work we are doing. You don't have to limit this to art only.
Right.
See, whether you hammer a few nails in the sauna, you know, or make the sunning area beautiful or something like that, you want to do something and not go there and destroy it. So
sure.
The destruction,
yeah.
You know, doesn't last so long, fortunately, than the construction. So these periods were always very short, strangely enough. Or not so strangely enough, depends on the, so let's hope that our destructive in quotation marks age will not last so long.
But do you think that if I could say some of the contemporary painters, like say a de Kooning, don't you feel they feel they are creating?
Oh yes, but again the whole idea behind the work is so different.
Yeah. Well it is destroying traditional forms. But
yeah, but not replacing them by a new form, but replacing them by an anti-form.
Yeah, I could say.
You see, that is the point. It's not just something different, something bitter, but it's a no. In general, not against a few years of tradition.
I wonder if there's any analogy at all here. But it's very interesting that science has actually produced new ideas, new thinking, new theories by anti-science. I don't use it in the same sense you used anti-form, but the idea of a symmetry, a reaction, something at an opposite pole, has produced in modern science the anti-particle, the anti-universe concept. So possibly, maybe there's no good analogy at all here, but possibly the flight from the old into something new as a reaction, as a diametrically opposite kind of thing is also creative, and it doesn't have
right.
as much of that destructive will to destroy the old so much as the counter point. And even music uses that, does
right.
it not?
Right. And the amazing,
all bad,
the amazing thing is these, it's a destructive or anti-form, whatever you want to call it, works are much more appealing. In a strange way, you know, when we look at this marvelous statue or something like this, we look at it and say, well, this is kind of remote, it's
yeah.
beautiful, okay, but it leaves us cold in a certain way. Whereas when we have this unfinished work, this intentionally unfinished work, you know, we find little glimpses, you know, little steps that we can take much more easily, and all of a sudden we are in it. I don't know whether you have the same feeling.
Yeah. Isn't part of it a shock reaction? I've seen people get up and leave a concert when they started playing some Schoenberg or Webern and just say, you know, really, furious, that isn't music.
Exactly.
Yeah, 12-tone music certainly was more than just experimentation. I'm not a musician. I don't understand it very
yeah, but you
well.
Have
I can
the,
listen to
you
it.
You have the same thing. I mean, actually, this 12-tone thing is nothing new. The scale, has,
yes.
There was always the possibility to divide an octave into
sure.
12
mm-hmm.
half-tones, you know. Only what they do, they sort of mathematize that
that's
whole
right.
thing, you know. They come with a slide rule and construct music from this point of view. And actually, you need mathematics in order to follow what they are doing.
Right.
So it's perfectly constructed, but the basic thing in music is that it should sound.
Right, but not
that
there
should be a sound, and this is not there.
I can do that with my slide rule, but I can't compose. All I'm saying is I think it's possible, isn't it, to still like both forms, form or anti-form.
Oh, definitely so.
I'm not
counting
the music of any sort, and yet I can listen and enjoy the both, and to a certain extent enjoy modern art, although I happen to still like the classical better, which puts me in another generation, I guess. So that's manner, that's what you call
yeah,
I
didn't invent this, but this is one I think, a very good method of looking and criticizing it. I mean, you should be aware what you are looking at, simply, and approach one work from this point of view, you know, and the other one from another point of view. I mean, it would be ridiculous to look at Michelangelo's David from a mannerist point of view. See, you wouldn't say, well, where are the two contrasts? Where are the two poles? They aren't there anymore. They are one in this symbol, you know, which he created. And the same thing, you would go entirely wrong if you said that the slaves on the tomb, I mean, the mannerist or the final, the last judgment, for instance, when you approach this from a classical point of view and say, where is the focal point? there ain't no focal point in that thing. That whole thing is just bubbling, you know. Yeah. It's intentionally torn apart. It's up and down, and there is no rest, no stillness in it, so to speak. So just look at these things, you know, and say, well, this is mannerist technique, the opposite, the no technique, or whatever you want to call it, and evaluate this work from that point of view.
Isn't that fundamental? That's fundamental to science. I've never heard your word at all. There's nothing. Science doesn't start from any particular point. It starts from a set of postulates, and certainly the scientific method, you know that there's no such thing. There may be a focal point in a restrictive sense, but it has no magic. Science starts with postulates. It's faith, you might say, the same way religion does.
Yeah, but don't we have a very similar thing in the sciences nowadays? I mean, before, let's say in 19th century positivism, we thought that if we followed our logical thinking, there was only one possibility. If it didn't work, then our mind wasn't skilled enough. You went on and on and on. And nowadays, I mean, look at this very simple example of that thing up there, namely light. You have one experiment, and you use light as a particle or a corpuscle. And you have another one, and you use light as a wave. Actually, two things completely opposed to each other. And you cannot say which is right.
Oh, but they're they reduce the same thing mathematically. They're mathematical analogs. No, I feel that this partly comes with understanding, but I think that the people who felt that didn't understand what logic is. Logic is only a set of rules. You lay down a set of rules, you say, this is the way we'll reason. After all, mathematics is the same way. So, the people who lose sight of the fact that you have to start with a set of freely assumed postulates, which are not provable, and then following your logic, if you make no mistakes in logic, which is playing the game according to the rules, you come to a conclusion. That conclusion may or may not be valid, and the only way you can tell if it's valid is to now, if it's in the physical science, put it to the measurable test. And if you measure things in the laboratory and those conclusions don't check out, you say, well, obviously, if I haven't violated the logic, then this theory doesn't fit. I used the wrong postulate, so you go back. But there's nothing magic about that.
Yeah, but you realize only in the 20th century, I would say, that this is one possibility only.
Mm-hmm.
That you could also start explaining this phenomenon, which you are looking at inside, from a different point of view,
right,
from a different postulate. And this is something the 19th century, for instance, did not believe. That there should be only one and it should be universal.
Well, of course, what the 19th century believed and what logical thinkers and philosophers believe may be a little bit different. But I do agree, the big problem, for instance, modern physics presented a great problem because one had to, the best theory that worked out was not a physical continuous theory, it was a quantum theory. And people got hung up because they couldn't equate that with the things they see. It took them a while to realize that the basic fundamental submicroscopic world is quite different. It has no solidity.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought, I didn't want to go on that, I just thought maybe there was a little analogy here that
definitely there is.
Thinking actually is
definitely
20th century science.
Because, I mean, science was the only, used to be the only field where you thought it's very clear. You have one postulate, get that clear, you know, feed the right thing in the computer and it'll work.
Right.
You see, whereas nowadays, even science, this safe, sure, certain science, you know, also has several aspects.
Absolutely.
They are both correct. And light is the best example. That's strange thing.
I've never been hung up on that. I always used to people say, how can you be a scientist and believe in a God? And it's real simple.
Exactly. There's never been more scientists believing in God than now.
Science starts out with a set of postulates. And I can either believe in those postulates for science or the postulate there is a God for religion. There's no conflict to me. I believe what I like to believe. But that was where the mistake was. They somehow thought you could start out with some fundamental truth that science could prove, which it can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have I think there have never been more scientists going to churches or also appreciating art all of a sudden. You know,
because they understand the context of science, what its limitations are.
Yeah, that they don't say what the artists do or what the churches are doing, what theology is doing, is just baloney. It's not clear, it's not logical. All of a sudden they see their own field, you know, has also things that are not necessarily one-way streets. This is a very amazing thing that took place, and this it definitely is an analogy to this. Only the point is, what do we do with it?
Yeah.
When we try to create something, do we just concentrate on one, neglect the others, and say, well, all man can do is just do a little step, create something, build a house, write a poem, you know, or very simple things? Or do we just try to live with it and constantly present this divergence? You know, this
One thing that interests me.
These are the two ideas.
Yesterday you mentioned something with regard to some somber German poetry, which came out of an age in which the social and political climate within Germany was very, very good, very abundant.
Mm-hmm.
How does the poet, or can you say how a poet within context of a society gets the idea that forms the so that it fits in this manneristic period, which may be completely contrasted to a political or social period? In other words, he's not necessarily motivated to write poetry which is consonant or in harmony with
the term classical is used, classical or mm-hmm. mannerism.
What causes that? There must be some psychology that's working in the person who is writing that gives him the idea to proceed as he does, whether it's destruction of form, whether mm-hmm. it's a harmonious relationship. If he doesn't get it from the time within which he lives, is there any explanation for how this develops?
Maybe this is a little different in Europe, where the connection artist-society is not as close as in the United States. The poet is usually one who stands much further apart from what is going on in society. And where Germany was booming at that time, you know, was politically, economically, socially, but not in thinking, for instance, not in theology, not in philosophy, not in art. See, and from this point of view, I think these poets just look deeper, a little further ahead, seeing that also in politics, in economics, it was nothing, it looked nice, but it only looked nice, it wasn't nice. And the First World War, you know, that broke out a little later and gave them right. It showed that they were right, that this was only a hollow convention. You didn't need a war. I mean, the same thing is happening right now here. An institution that we trusted and took for granted, all of a sudden I discovered to be hollow by it isn't the whole will of people, or the will of the people.
By definition, aren't the real contributors of history, the geniuses, if you like, the ones that have a whole new effect on religion, let's say, or science, or art, aren't they sort of, by definition, people who are ahead of their time? They're not mm-hmm. the followers, but they're people, Einstein, for example, in his theory of relativity, complete rejection of some other things, a creative kind of rejection, but can you look in the contemporaries and say that what made them do what they did was drawn from them? I somehow feel that it's part of the mainstream of the development of the human mind, and that they, in fact, were ahead of their time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, maybe this question of the of society and artists, maybe we can just briefly mention this a little later. I mentioned yesterday that from this point of view, that all of a sudden artists, especially poets, became aware of the fact that there, in their own strangeness, had a certain tradition. In other words, that they discovered they were, in quotation marks, mannerist poets before. They picked out new ones, new ancestors of the so-called modern movement of modern art, modern poetry, modern literature. Poets which had been neglected before. And so from this point of view, let me just give you more or less nothing but the names of a few poets that became, from this point of view, ancestors of our contemporary art. Strangely enough, number one, the most influential of all of them, was the American Walt Whitman. I don't know about here. Yes?
No, I had nothing to say.
Okay. It is not in Europe, at least, you are all familiar with Walt Whitman, at least, on Leaves of Grass. Is that a standard thing in high school?
Yeah.
Still is?
I've forgotten everything I've ever read in poetry.
No, tremendously early, 1855 already, with his first anthology. It was a little thin and then got thicker and thicker, you know, as he went on and became more successful. In Europe, it's not so much that he praised democracy, that he praised America, but it's the way how he praised it, for one thing. And secondly, that he's praising a kind of a new mass age. It's not so much the gilded, nice, pretty things, you know, that usually you found in the 19th century, but that this man looked deeper, saw the masses, and saw, very optimistically, saw a chance of something good that could come out of it. So So the influence he exerted was by this elementary and powerful or vigorous rhythm in his lines, as opposed to this lulling sweetness, this party poetry. I don't know whether you're familiar with these situations in Germany. Usually, it were officers, you know, a young lieutenant all of a sudden got up, you know, and said, here's the new poem, and then he came up with it, you know, what could the guy do? Then just a toast or something like this, you know, and you got some stars and the motherland and flowers and love, you know, all toasted with a champagne glass, you know, this kind. All of a sudden something completely different came up with Walt Whitman. He was almost immediately translated into French, into German, and was highly appraised in all over Europe, and still looked upon as one of the really most influential ancestors of modern literature in Europe and the United States too. We may add, although this is not poetry, strictly speaking, another guy who is, as I learned from old tweet, is almost completely forgotten now. It is namely Poe. In all European universities, Poe is the man, the ancestor for modern art. Just like Whitman, only in a different field, it's of course his imagery. And Poe is just a textbook example for mannerism.
Again.
See, here you have him. This is why he is so highly acclaimed in Europe. Now this arabesque and grotesque, isn't that the title, Tales of the Arabesque and Grotesque? It's just the thing, you know, this ambiguity in between and the horror. And this made him also tremendously influential. It's not so much that he is one of the first to write suspense stories. This is, I think, the reason for the fact that he is still mentioned here. So his stories in Europe are not looked upon as suspense stories, but as something vague, something that cannot be structured, something that's sort of lurching behind, you know, and this made him influential. Then, maybe when we hop over and just finish this little list of ancestors of modern poetry, modern art, we should mention the Frenchman Charles Baudelaire. If you ever heard of him, just Charles Baudelaire, B-A-U-D-E-L-A-I-R-E, Baudelaire. With a famous collection of poetry, the Fleur du Mal, or Flowers of Evil. Flowers of Evil. Also very early, 1857 already. Now don't forget that Goethe, the arch classical poet, died in 1832. And this is 1857, just 30 years later, roughly speaking. At his time, nobody took much notice of Charles Baudelaire, but later on, again from this point of view, that mannerist poetry was the kind of poetry that was to survive. He became a great prophet of the time with his Fleur du Mal. Now here we don't have a renewal of the form as with Whitman, you know, a new sentence is struck, a new rhythm, new meter. But he's using the old traditional forms, but the point that made him interesting is that he is glorifying evil as well as good.
Why would you put wild in that?
Pardon?
Why wouldn't you put Oscar Wilde?
You could if you wanted to. But this is more a reaction against something. I wouldn't say that he is strictly a mannerist.
No, but
he had
some, if I understand it, he would have some elements.
Oh yes. I mean, the his whole, it's more his life that was mannerist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So it is with Baudelaire, more or less, it is this theme of suffering under the curse of coldness, of beauty, which he pursues. Maybe I just jotted down a little line from one of his poems where it says, I want neither testament, nor grave, nor tomb. I don't want tears from anybody. I'd rather invite crows that they devour my decaying body. So he's still looking for beauty, looking for something, while he is praising the opposite. The destruction. So this strange tension in his poetry, you know, this is what became influential, not so much the form was very traditional. Now, the next one we might add is the Englishman, this time Gerard Manley Hopkins, who is tremendously well-known in Holden, isn't he?
Yeah.
Since he is a religious poet in quotation marks, also he already died in 1844 to 1889. He was completely forgotten, that's significant enough, I think. Till 1930, nobody took notice of him. Only in 1930, all of a sudden, they found these strange rhythm to these strange lines. Have you all heard poem poetry by Gerard Manley Hopkins, The Wind Hover or something like this? There are lots of anthologies right here in the Koinonia Library. Religious poetry, but it is actually the religious feeling that started in him this kind of poetry, which is completely new, I might say, in that he's using alliterations, a strange kind of rhythm which just is thunders on from word to word to word, you know. And he's also using rare words, you know, to express this kind of feeling. I don't have anything here, I should have, but I don't. So it's more or less this religious ecstasy that sort of freed a new rhythmic and melodic way of saying what he had to say. Then again, something completely different, this time in Ireland, namely William Butler Yeats. Is that name known? Y-E-A-T-S. William Butler Yeats. Here, strangely enough, this man is, let's say, rooted in Irish myths. And also something that you again and again find in mannerism, namely the occult. Is that a familiar term, hermeneutics or hermeneutics, or the occult, the eccentrics, mannerism? This is all connected with them, something you cannot study. There is no chair at the university for the occult. What we have, yeah, they used to be. I mean, even in the up to the 18th century, there were still chairs for astrology. There was a fifth and a sixth and the seventh book of Moses in theology, which was studied. Right. I mean, this is an old tradition that the so-called free universities are taking up again. You know, the history of the occult. What we have actually is nothing but country fair, watered-down forms, namely our horoscopes, you know, and the old gypsy lady looking to the lines of your hand or something like this. But it is something that used to be much, much more serious than now it is. We just have the most watered-down form. But it was tremendously serious, and Yeats is one of them who goes back. The Irishman Joyce, in his Ulysses, goes back to that too. Maybe some of you are familiar with this Ulysses. T.S. Eliot, of course, knows. I mean, he has an old card, isn't it, in the wasteland? Pardon?
The Tarot.
Right, this Tarot thing, you know, another thing, with a wicked pack of cards, and he calls it wicked, but that's what he means. You know, again, this dubious occult idea. You know, sure, Eliot knew about this. And especially in Joyce, in the Ulysses, where he just takes the human body, as you probably know, and has each of the main organs, actually, there has a certain meaning. This goes way back to Egypt. The heart means something, the kidney means something, and so on. This is connected with one constellation in each chapter. You probably have seen analyses of the novel. So people are aware of this. But so with Yeats, it is more complicated because these myths, which are in a certain way also occult, you know, and let's say an occult image of the divine, of God. It is not divine in that it is, let's say, formed in a certain religion, but it's left in an image which is not, again, which is not centered in the symbol of God, but which is left open. So you may also see this contrast that we were talking about in the contrast myth-religion. It's very interesting, but tremendously wide field.
Yeats actually developed his own mythology, his own cosmology.
Yeah, but still it is rooted in Ireland.
Yeah, it's rooted in the...
Yeah, when he wrote...
It's a projection of the old into the future.
Right. Uh-huh. We may also add in Russia, have you ever heard of Alexander Blok, B-L-O-K? A strange, rather, at that time still the Russian poets were considered to be 100% communist. I mean, that was it, that branded them, and they were never read in the West. But still, this man lived from 1880 to 1921, and he was inspired by the Russian Revolution, strangely enough. Now, the thing that made him interesting for other poets and for literature in the West was the fact that he hailed this new era after the Russian Revolution. But strangely enough, in his most famous ballad called the Twelve Apostles, they are Bolsheviks marching, but and they are all led by Christ. You see, Christ marches ahead with a red Bolshevik flag, you know, and leads the communists to victory. So you have this strange contrast between Christianity, you know, and Bolshevism in one poem. And otherwise, his form is very similar to Whitman. He knew Whitman. Pardon? The 12.
The 12.
The 12. It's about 20, 30 pages. A very, very, very long ballad.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I have, I think
I... B-L-O-C, did you say?
Pardon?
What is it? Block?
Block, yeah. B-L-O-K.
Okay.
It's a little hard because the Russians have different letters. So, but this is usually what how it's transcribed. There's a lip. I don't know whether it's this one or not. Maybe just the last part of this long thing. Well, he just describes how they march and what happens and how somebody here comes out and somebody there joins them and so on. And somebody doesn't want to come along. And he says, well, we shall get you, no mistake. Better come or curse your lot. Comrade out or never wait. We shall rake you with our shot. And then crack, 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 supposed to be the shot. The echoes peal startling noises in their rows, only blizzards laughs and reel, laughing vastly through the snows. On they march with sovereign tread, and behind the mongrel lean, in advance with flag blood red, and because of blizzard all unseen and unharmed by hail of lead, over snow with soft step light, showered in myriad pearls of snow, crowned with wreath of roses white, Jesus Christ walks on ahead. Isn't that great? He's supposed to be the father of contemporary Russian poetry, you know, Alexander Blok, so we may add him. And then just to, we have to finish because Leo will start talking about death now. Again, very mannerist, you know, imagine 50 years ago somebody had a lecture on death, nobody would come.
Yeah.
But this, you know, but this is interesting, it will be packed, I think, you know, despite, here we have the most beautiful sunshine outside. But this is something that interests us, you know, this mystery of death.
I asked Leo why he had such a morbid subject going through nuclear warfare and VWCW and death and so on. He said, well, I usually pick things that have a high probability of happening. Death is one.
Right. He can joke about this. I mean, this you see this manner of thinking in everywhere, actually. So, but just to finish it off, there's one more, I would say this time, movement, namely the so-called German Expressionist movement, which we mentioned earlier. This group I mentioned yesterday also, you know, about 20 poets, most of them got killed in the First World War, who started revolting, you know, a genuine revolt against the traditional poetry of the 19th century. They started writing a new kind of poetry. For one thing, it was first a shock, in that they portrayed the hidden ugliness under the surface, you know, and they exaggerated intentionally the dirt and the filth, you know, and just in order to shock, to awaken the complacent bourgeois, as they usually say. Mm. A good example is the surgeon Gottfried Benn. We read some funny examples. B-E-N-N. That's one of the two who survived. They did not get killed in action in the First World War. They were all draft age. And so the vast majority, just all with the exception of two, got killed in action. So, but Ben, the surgeon, he was a medic, of course, in the war, then he did not have to fight in the front, and so he survived. Now, in connection with this, and this is quite interesting, also something we could discuss, it was not only that there was a group of the so-called expressionist poets, at the same time, there were artists trying to renew art and architecture. There's one movement, I don't know whether you're familiar with it, this is called the Blue Rider movement. There's a book I'm just translating. That's why it's probably not yet known. Because it has not yet appeared, but it appeared in 1912 for the first time.
Blue Rider? Or
yeah, Rider. Have you ever heard of the names of Kandinsky, the painter, or?
Mm-hmm.
Right, these guys, Franz Marc, M-A-R-C, who painted all the horses. You usually see these paintings in insurance buildings or something like that. They are tremendously popular. Now. Or maybe you know the guy who emigrated to the States, Lionel Feininger, with his New York skyscraper technique where he started with. That's also something you see in almost every Montgomery Ward store, at least in ours. There's a big Feininger right there. When you ask the kids, have you ever heard the Feininger? No. Same thing. well, this group. Now, they also try to renew art, not only painting, not only sculpture, but all of the arts together. So they invited poets, architects, everybody just to collaborate with them in almanacs, in music. Schoenberg, for instance, worked with them.
And these architects would be a little later generation than the Gropius and the Van der Rohe?
No, younger, about 10 years younger.
Oh, I'm sorry, I inverted, that's what I meant. They would be younger. Gropius and Van der Rohe were earlier.
Yeah, this Blue Rider movement, the painters, Kandinsky, Mark primarily, you know, and many, Kandinsky was a Russian, and there were more Yablinsky and probably guys you've never heard before the book's printed.
Binder was later or earlier?
No, at the same time. He joined them too. The composer Schoenberg, who was Jewish and he had to emigrate, that's why he survived. But most of the others, Macke is another painter, M-A-C-K-E, just like a Mack truck, only with an E at the end. They only were, well, 28, 30 years. First World War, bang, that was it, killed near Verdun. And that is the reason why this Blue Rider movement, which was tremendously influential, died. You know, Kandinsky survived, he was older, he didn't want to go on alone. And then they started something new, a new colony of this. They continued this, and this time it was the architect Gropius, and later on Mies van der Rohe, or van der Rohe as he is pronounced here, with this so-called Bauhaus, which you probably heard of. Right. This Bauhaus, the idea was to concentrate all the arts together and have them work together at new projects, not isolate them as they were before. You know, there's no connection artist or society usually. They work on their own, hoping that after some years the value of their work would become evident. But they said, no, if we want to be really influential and get away from false critics, from rich Jews in New York, you know, who dictate what is good and so on, we have to concentrate, we have to live together and work together at projects. And this was the first the Blue Rider idea, you know, and then the Bauhaus idea in Weimar, Dessau first, and then of course came Adolf the Great, Hitler, you know, and called this degenerated or distorted art. That was the end of it. But Gropius and Mies van der Rohe went to New York, where a so-called the New Bauhaus, they kept the German title, the New Bauhaus, was found and still exists.
Does that concept really work? Does it really?
Yeah, this is the question, you know.
I mean, I don't know. I've never heard of it's perhaps too close to
No, it worked for one thing, and
really,
in that, for instance, architecture, Gropius and Mies van der Rohe, this worked in that for the first time they constructed good factories, good schools, good office buildings.
Combining of the functional with the aesthetic.
Exactly. So, yeah, and also making use of the new materials.
Yeah, but isn't that more a combining of the art and the engineering rather than combining of all of the arts, or unless you call it perhaps the
not really, because Kandinsky, who survived, thought that that his paintings, I mean, usually called composition so-and-so, no title, mm-hmm. would fit into these buildings,
yeah.
and not a cheap copy of a reproduction of Mona Lisa. That would be ridiculous. Or what we usually find in 5 and 10 stores nowadays, you know, these great works. So it worked that they constructed new factories. I mean, yeah. The first thing they really did was a shoe factory. Well, for the first time they used glass and concrete, you know, and still had, it looked excellent. It was functional and it looked marvelous.
Yeah. Combining of the arts with engineering and with the
right, this
functional,
was
this, I feel, does work. I misunderstood. I thought you were saying if you take all of the arts and put them together, the painters and the architects and the musicians, does that work in a Bauhaus idea? Does that make them all more creative in a synergistic way?
Yes. I mean, they had a rather, we might call this romantic idea again, namely of a synthesis of all the arts.
Mm.
You see, Kandinsky, for instance, wrote a play which is almost a painting in motion. No, it's called The Yellow Sound, strangely enough, you know, where you have nothing, you don't have characters on the stage, but you just have figures. Their only purpose is to have a certain color. And it's just a constant moving of color and sound, you know. A composer set this thing to music. So you have color and sound moving on the stage, no plot, you know, no filthy happy ending, as they call it. So there it worked together. And they, as we saw right now, you have similar ideas. The basic idea is the same. And so even Schoenberg could collaborate, and others too. And the strange, this is something we also just touched upon yesterday. The Russians did a similar thing near Moscow. They had a similar colony. This was primarily just to go away from the German soldiers who were approaching Moscow. And so they moved a little bit east of Moscow and founded a colony where they concentrated all the artists. And there's a similar attempt, if I'm not mistaken, here in the States, and where is it? Somewhere in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I think.
Taos.
Pardon? Taos. Yeah, it's close to Santa Fe, isn't it? Yeah. Way up in the hills where all the big shots are.
Yep.
And now all the hippies.
I didn't know that. But it's this is the similar idea, so it spread, actually.
You can even see it at Golden Village at our Christmas celebration, with the sculptures and the writers and the dancers and everyone getting together to put,
a real festival.
Yeah, put everything together.
Of course, it's always this question, how much does the artist communicate? Should he live within society, or should he be sort of put in way up into the hills in New Mexico and live there? And then, after a necessary contemplation and concentration, then exert his influence back to society. But when he lives up there, he's not a member of society, of his own society. That's why the hippies probably like it. It's not a structured society. I don't know, I rather favor this idea, but because I don't think the artist pays too much attention to society when he writes something, creates something, in general. So I like this idea. You see what comes out of this Russian colony, I forgot it, I forgot the name of it. Does anybody know? Some 50 miles east of Moscow. Beautiful area. This is where all the composers and painters are concentrated.
It seems to me that the opera was sort of a Bauhaus, a sort of separate unique art form, which involves many of the other arts. Drama, music,
right,
orchestra,
right.
And very, very few people, Wagner and a few others who wrote operas, very few people, was it anything but a collaboration?
Mm-hmm.
Relatively few great opera composers that did their own librettos.
Right.
Or orchestrated, or rather did the choreography for the ballets.
Right.
Really,
yeah, ballet is the same thing. They have the same idea. I mean, the thing I mentioned with Kandinsky is it's almost strikingly parallel to what they do in modern ballet.
Yeah, you can also see it in filmmaking.
Right.
Where you have good filmmaking, where you have a director and you have all these actors and a writer and all these different people working together.
Yeah, but in filmmaking, I think you have this Italian colony again.
Yeah, you do.
You know, you have Antonioni above all. Right, and they, or Fellini. And what they do, this is just amazing. I don't know how many Antonioni films have you seen, The Red Desert or something like this? And all of a sudden he's changing color in order to get the meaning, not just this Hollywood schmaltz.
No, I meant the Godard and
Right, but again the same idea, concentrate in one certain place instead of being an immediate member of society.
It's funny, when you refer to artists, I have seen some of the films which I have liked, but then I have seen some of the films which have had the sort of a dissonance as the motif, where to me it's unstructured, it's difficult, it's symbolism, it's difficult to understand, and it may be art, but it's funny, I wouldn't call it. At least it's not art I appreciate, because it's not in my mind set. It's too far out for me to appreciate. Far out, not left or right, but it's within the area in which I can enjoy something.
Yeah, quickly, would you remember a title?
Oh, let's see if I can think of one, because I've been to... No, offhand I don't.
And this is another aspect of the manner, is that the lack of formal structure is an essential part of it.
But what usually comes out of these concentrations in is that they think of their own means much more clearly than before. But all of a sudden the Italian filmmaker think, what is a film? And it's certainly not a schmaltzy love story. See, when all of a sudden they say a film, what is it? It is a picture. The word is not so important.
Yeah,
so
I love the sound of music. That's my problem.
That's sure.
In that sense, the film has gone to a much more creative art form. Originally, it had writers. The thing was the visual impression and writing for the films. But that's all changed. And
Ulysses.
The most striking thing is the music.
Mm-hmm.
Because instead of just being things taken from the classic or something that seemed to fit with the action, I gather now, read Bernstein, some of these musicians really feel that there is room, and much of that music is now being written for the film itself, and they really feel this is now an art form.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a generation ago, it really wasn't.
Yeah, because they are thinking back of actually what it should be.
Yeah.
Namely just a picture. I mean, all of a sudden, the silent films are coming, or the Japanese films. I don't know whether you've seen these.
Yes.
What are they called? The Woman in the Dunes or something like this?
Yeah.
Or the one where nothing is shown but the one family living on the little island and rowing back and forth and getting the water and watering the little boy comes back from school. There's hardly a word spoken. The man spanks his wife once because she drops a pail of water. Nothing else. You don't need that. It is the picture that counts. You know, the picture, nothing else.
There was a knife. Was that the Polish film?
Right, that's a Polish film. The knife.
Yeah, which, yeah, that had a definite...
Right.
That had a definite plot, though.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Photography was different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Leo is up there. Really. Do you want to lecture from up there, Leo?
No, I'll be down.
You'll be down. Closer to the grave.
Let's all die down here, not up there.
Just up by.